Underwriting for AutoLine this week, provided by...
People are going to have apprehensions about going into the dealership because it's the largest purchase they're going to make in their lifetime next to their house. So they have to figure, can I afford this? TrueCar gets to the heart of the matter. Within 60 seconds, you're going to find out what the average customer is paying for that car. TrueCar helps you enjoy the car buying process because you're spending less time negotiating price. You're going to find yourself focusing on what's the right car for you and have a lot of fun with that.
Experience a whole new way to buy a car with TrueCar.
From the AutoLine Studios, here is your host, John McElroy.
I want to thank you all for joining us on AutoLine this week, where the discussion's all going to be about fuel cells and the hydrogen economy. Could this really be the future for the automotive industry? Let's find out. I've got three experts joining me today, including Chris Hennessy, the Vice President of Engineering for the engineering consulting group called IAV Automotive. Professor Levi Thompson is with the College of Engineering at the University of Michigan, and Gil Castillo is the Senior Group Manager for Alternative Vehicle and Advanced Vehicle Strategy at Hyundai Motor America. And it's great having three experts like you on AutoLine this week.
Thank you.
Professor Levi Thompson, let me start with you. And I'll start off by saying, man, I've been reading and writing about fuel cells for a couple of decades now. In fact, I think I drove my first fuel cell car almost 20 years ago. And everyone's kept on saying, the fuel cell's the future of the auto industry. And here we are in 2015, and maybe it looks like it's a little bit closer. But my question is, why has it taken so long for this technology to come to the forefront?
Well, part of it's the challenges that you're facing. The incumbent is very inexpensive. Whatever is destined to replace it will have to be at least as good and in some cases better. It can't cost as much. So all of those, I'm a technology person, all of those rolled up results in the technology not being ready. So it's not ready in terms of durability, how long it'll last. It's not ready in terms of cost. They're just a variety of different reasons why it's not ready. And there's been tremendous progress. And you can sort of see the light at the end of the tunnel. And I think that's one of the consequences is that you're hearing more about commercialization from Hyundai and Toyota, some of the other companies, GM, and the domestics have been involved as well. So just a lot of technical issues, and they result in cost challenges.
Chris, how do you see it? And I should add, IAV, you guys are pretty agnostic. You'll consult on any kind of powertrain or power plant and the like, and even more than just that. But what do you see as the real hurdles that have yet to be overcome to make fuel cells an everyday occurrence for most motorists?
I think, over the last 15 years, spent time in natural gas, in the battery side of the business, and what we see as the linchpin is the commercialization. So needing to get a volume base so that we can get piece price costs down, needing to get the infrastructure there to support mass adoption by consumers so that they're not feeling the range anxiety that they talk about in the battery space. And there's a preponderance in new technology to say all or nothing. And so there's a focus on development of fuel cell has got to replace the entire powertrain of the vehicle and be the solution. And I think what we're seeing now with some of the battery technology that was developed and invested in the Michigan capital investment over the last 10 years is not maintaining that all or nothing strategy, having a subsystem level approach where you can have a lower battery, meet a price point target, get some of the overall system performance, and try and incrementally introduce some of the technology into the powertrain, because all or nothing has a very hard line from a performance standpoint that some consumers aren't willing to risk, and it constrains the market opportunity. And then also from a technology standpoint, it limits the potential range of usage in low temperatures and environmental conditions that are outside a median. And so for me, starting in a lower volume market and allowing it to grow up and mature in a subsystem level would help actually bring a lot of the technologies that are in incubation phase forward in a more expedient manner.
Gil Hyundai is now offering a fuel cell vehicle, right, almost really on a test basis, but you're putting them in the hands of real-life consumers.
That's right.
So what were some of the things that led to a breakthrough enabling Hyundai to be able to do that?
Well, I think everything that's been said is, you know, correct. There's a lot of moving pieces when it comes to fuel cell technology, because it's not just the vehicle itself, it's the infrastructure, right? Finding a place to fuel it. And recently, there's been a lot of action taking place, especially in California, to put infrastructure in place, which is kind of now alleviating this whole chicken and egg issue, which is why, you know, Hyundai decided and took the step to introduce a vehicle. Actually, in terms of development timing, Hyundai first produced its first in-house stack in 2006, so less than, you know, 9 years ago. We're already in the third generation, and it's a stack that we think is ready for prime time in terms of durability, in terms of performance and such. But really, like we're saying, it's got to start somewhere. And just like there was a time when gasoline and electric vehicles were competing against each other, gasoline won out because it had better performance and better characteristics, even though there was no infrastructure. I think fuel cells kind of starting kind of in that same area, where once the infrastructure is moves out and is more available, I think that's where I think consumers will see the benefits of fuel cell technology, at least relative to other zero emission technologies.
Levi, is that going to be enough, though? We see demonstration projects, notably in California, in this country. Germany is doing some stuff. Japan seems to be off to the races with this. But these are largely demonstration projects. Can we really scale up an infrastructure to enable fuel cell cars?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's done. If you look at new technologies, that's the way it happens. It's conceived, there's some demonstration, and you work out all the bugs, and then you go to, if it's ready, you go to full deployment. And so I think with fuel cells, you know, I think about the work we do in labs. It's under a relatively narrow window of conditions that are somewhat representative of what the real world is like, but not really. So a day like today, if you were to take a fuel cell car outside,
and we should let the audience know, it's freezing cold out there and there's piles of snow, right?
There's piles of snow. There are all kinds of environmental issues that you would have to deal with. And so trying to understand how that technology interacts with the environment that it's in is an important part of getting it to commercial product. And some of that work is demonstration, you know, getting a couple hundred cars out on the road just to see how they perform. The consumer will also become more familiar with it. A lot of people are nervous about using hydrogen. And, you know, when you look at it from a scientific perspective, it's a no-brainer. It makes a lot of sense. When you look at it as a consumer, I have my children in the car, I worry. Actually, let me say that another way. I don't worry, because it's actually a very safe technology. But if you don't know, if you're ignorant about it, then you start to listen to what you hear, you know, in the public media, and just things get construed and distorted. And I think you need those demonstrations just to show that it is a safe, reliable, consumer-ready technology. And so without the demonstration, I don't think you'd be able to get there.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, so many people I talk to in the general public, you know, their immediate image is of a burning Zeppelin. Yep. That's what everyone thinks in this. Chris, let me ask you, though, even though Levi's very confident of the infrastructure being put in place, we've seen all kinds of public electric charging stations be put in place, and yet EVs, electric cars, electric vehicles, haven't hit that critical point everybody thought they would have by this point. Mm-hmm. So again, can we get enough of an infrastructure out there to enable fuel cell cars?
I think, yeah, it's possible, but it's not going to be driven by just the automotive industry. It's a need to collaborate with the energy sector and get the necessary support to install the infrastructure there and have a larger availability. The fleets, the demonstration fleets that are being set up now are largely driven by the OEMs themselves and bearing the cost of the burden of the infrastructure to allow those fleets to occur. And so we have a chicken or eggs situation right now where the investment isn't going into mass proliferation because the vehicles don't exist, and the vehicles don't exist because there's no consumers that will buy them without the infrastructure to support them. So it has to grow out of a collaborative effort between the automotive industry and the infrastructure side so that it can take hold and start to expand.
So I think that's where it's changing in California, right? So last year was a pivotal year for us in terms of AB 8, where California is dedicating $20 million a year for the construction of up to 100 or over 100 fueling stations. Last year, we saw 28 stations being funded, so now the total is around 51 stations. So certainly, it's very localized. Mm-hmm. But I think once you start off in a community in an area as big as LA and Orange County, and then with the vehicles like the Tucson, Toyota, and Honda come into play, I think that's when we'll start to see a little bit more vehicles, consumers getting more confidence in such with the technology, and hopefully, like we said, grows from there. Pretty soon, we'll be in the Bay Area, Sacramento, San Diego. And there's also a lot of talk in Northeast, right, where I think there's a lot of potential for fuel cell technology up there.
What do your studies show of? What kind of density of refueling stations do you need before the public really becomes comfortable with it?
Well, there's actually been a lot of studies done by University of California, Irvine, UC Davis and such. And what they showed is you needed a minimum of 68 stations to provide sufficient density. Now, it wouldn't be throughout the state, but rather be in larger metropolitan areas. With 68 stations, you could support several thousand vehicles. So with 100 stations, that enables us to put stations not only where people live, but also connector stations so they can drive to and from North and Southern California. Also stations, let's say Santa Barbara, Palm Springs, where people vacation. So I think with 100 stations, you'll see that there'll probably be enough redundancy in the network so that if people, let's say their primary station goes down, they have more than enough options available to them.
Now, I would imagine that's true for early adopters who will easily drive out of their way to go to a refueling station or even an EV charging station. They'll do it. The general public, I get the idea, is not going to be putting up with having to go out of their way to refuel.
That's true, I think. And certainly there are a lot of early adopters very interested in the technology, being the first out there, first mover. But surprisingly, there are a lot of people who are purchasing or leasing our vehicle who wouldn't fit the mold of an early adopter. They're actually looking at it from a cost savings. Part of our lease is the free fuel, right? So you can fuel your vehicle as part of the lease. Don't worry about it. And what we're finding is a lot of these consumers actually aren't as turned off by the station situation. There's a learning period, granted. There's a learning period. And I think once people understand what's going on and the nuances of where the stations are, they get adjusted to it. But certainly, once there's sufficient number of stations, and that's where we're headed, I think it'll alleviate a lot of those concerns for many consumers.
Levi, you cannot drill a hole in the ground and have hydrogen come bubbling up. You have to manufacture it, and that takes energy. How much can this country or the world scale up its hydrogen production? And really, since you need energy to do it, how green really is this fuel?
So, as it turns out, we produce a tremendous amount of hydrogen, not for fuel cell vehicles, but for ammonia production, which is used in making fertilizers for food production, refining crude oil to make it into gasoline. That's a tremendous footprint for hydrogen. It does cost energy because it doesn't exist as a molecule. It's in other molecules, so you have to sort of take it out. But there are very green strategies for doing that. If you consider, for example, water electrolysis, you can take solar energy, convert it into electricity, use that to drive electrolysis, make hydrogen and oxygen. The oxygen could be used for something as well. And that would be, quote unquote, green. You know, you use a renewable, sustainable natural resource.
But if you're using water, is that a good thing? I mean, there's a lot of concern worldwide now on water.
You know, with everything, if you are not careful about how it's done, you could create problems. But of course, we have an opportunity now at the early stages to consider water management. There are tremendous issues related to water. If we start creating more associated with using water to produce hydrogen, that's a non-starter. So at this early stage, we can start looking at that water energy, the water food, all of these nexuses, I guess. You can start considering those. And this is the perfect time. I mean, we have all of these challenges. Let's try to figure out how to address all of them more or less at the same time.
Also, if I can add, in terms of renewable hydrogen, actually right across the street from Hyundai's headquarters in Fountain Valley, there's what we call the OCSD station, which is Orange County Sanitation District. And what they actually do is they take sewage and use a tri-generation fuel cell to produce heat, electricity, and hydrogen. And in fact, most of the vehicles that we have are fueled by this biogas, which is basically comes from sewage. So there's a, you know, electrolysis is not the only, you know, direction for renewable hydrogen, but there are multiple pathways. And especially with sewage and biogas, you know, we know it's going to be around. And so there's an opportunity to produce a lot of hydrogen through that means.
I love the idea of making fuel out of garbage. Chris, how do you see it?
I think there's opportunity. I think, you know, when we talk about some of the technology challenges, the product development side, we can see a trajectory towards sustainability on the hardware and getting that proliferation. On the infrastructure side, it's now about taking these challenges and developing the technology that will support the various sources. So from an engineering challenge standpoint, it's looking at what is the sustainable solution and getting that development track in place and getting the reliability robustness. I mean, Gil mentioned the 100 stations, because if one goes down, it's a reliability issue. You know, you don't have gas stations going down right now because it's tried and true, it's a commodity. We need to get to that level of maturity in the hydrogen space as well, so that it's not a product that's being tested in the consumer's hands, that it's something that's ruggedized and ready for any type of environmental conditions. These are things that are going to only come out of the fleets that can expand and get the volumes there to support the investment into that infrastructure.
Chris, go ahead.
One of the really interesting things about hydrogen, because it is in so many other things, you're not dependent on one source. So right now, for gasoline, we're dependent largely on petroleum. If we were to use hydrogen, you could get it from petroleum, you get it from natural gas, both of which are fossil fuels. You could use water, you could use municipal waste. There are all of these other resources that you can use to get that same. Then you'll start to see competition. Whoever has the lowest cost product is probably going to win. And so that competition, I think, will drive the cost down.
That's a good point of competition, whoever comes up with the lowest cost. So, Chris, let me go back to you on this. Elon Musk poo-poos the idea of fuel cells. He calls them fool cells. And as you know, he's building this giant gigafactory to make batteries. What if all of a sudden he gets this breakthrough and the cost of batteries drops dramatically? How might that affect fuel cell adoption?
Well, I think that goes back to the premise that it's all or nothing. And from my standpoint, I don't see it being an all or nothing strategy. You know, fuel cells as a subsystem, as an energy generating device on the vehicle as a subsystem, but not necessarily the main propulsion, is also a viable solution. So I think from the standpoint of the technology migration, gasoline and diesel are here and are going to be here for quite a while. It's how do we get the technology maturity up in the other sectors so that they can start to incrementally support some of the strategic objectives that we have for CAFE in 2025 and the CO2 reduction initiatives, because it's not a silver bullet. It's, you know, every study that you see from the EPA and all of the industry, it's going to be driven by a need for all the technologies coming together to solve the problem. It's not an exclusive either or.
Yeah, so, I mean, certainly one could argue that Elon Musk has a vested interest in seeing fuel cells not succeed.
Yes, he does.
But I agree. I mean, it has to be kind of an all of the above kind of solution. Battery electric vehicles will certainly improve over time, I think. But there's always going to be a certain population who either doesn't have a place to plug in at home or at work, who maybe has driving range issues that are, you know, exceed what a battery electric can provide. Or maybe their family makeup requires them to have a bigger vehicle, right? That, as we know, battery electrics are kind of limited to smaller size platforms. And that's why we think that fuel cell technology is quite compatible with battery electric technology, right? For scalability of a fuel cell, the fact that you can have the long range, the fact that you can fuel very quickly, means that consumers don't have to compromise their regular driving behavior. But, you know, I think both can coexist along with plug-in vehicles and hybrids.
Gil, it seems to me that automakers are more and more placing their bets on hydrogen fuel cells. Toyota especially has mm-hmm. committed to that. Now Hyundai, of course, has its own vehicle. Honda just showed and has been leasing its vehicle, which, by the way, is a GM design fuel stack. So there's all this collaboration going on amongst automakers. I guess what I'm leading at in this is, When do you think the day might come where automakers can make these available to consumers and actually make a profit on them? Because we talk about sustainability from an environmental standpoint, we got to talk the business case sustainability as well.
Well, I think certainly it'll take a number of years just because, like we're saying, the numbers that we're looking at are quite small. But we've got to grow from someplace and from somewhere. It'll be a number of years before I think automakers will see some profitability with fuel cells. But I think importantly, there is a pathway. There's a cost reduction pathway for the stack, for a lot of the loading, potentially I think also with the tanks. And so unlike with battery electrics, at least from what we've seen, there is no real pathway at this point in terms of the technology breakthrough. So I think once the numbers come up, and of course that is all tied into the infrastructure, once we start seeing volumes in the thousands of units, I think that's when we start seeing some potential for at least break even.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Levi, when do you think that automakers might be able to make a profit on these cars?
I have no idea, to be honest with you. Just looking at it as a consumer, I have certain constraints with regard to what I'm willing to spend. I'm very interested. In fact, if you look at our house, we've done a lot of things to make it a lot more sustainable and renewable. We look at our automobiles when the time is right. I don't see it right around the corner necessarily, but you sense that it's coming. And there's usually an evolution. You know, I was going to say with regard to batteries and fuel cells, the move to a battery car, a car that's primarily driven by battery, it's going to be electrified. A fuel cell car will require that same electrification, and so whatever you learn there will benefit, whatever the battery people learn will benefit the fuel cell people. And of course, you're replacing the drivetrain. But there's a lot of synergy between the two. And maybe we shouldn't think of it as competition necessarily. Maybe one, I've seen these charts in particular from GM, where they look at, and this may be obsolete now because the leadership has changed a little bit, but I used to see these charts from gasoline, diesel, to batteries, and then ultimately to fuel cells with this expectation that there is a transition and you'll learn something from the prior technology and it'll actually benefit the next one.
So. Mm-hmm. And Chris, same question. When do you think that fuel cell cars might catch on with the public?
I think from a cost standpoint, we've gotten to the point where I think we've got a lot of the technology challenges on the concept and the prototype volumes. But the next hurdle to really make money in the industry is how do you scale that up into volume manufacturing? And that's another learning curve that's going to end up having to come when there's a line of sight to a higher volume market from a consumer basis. When you get to that type of level of technology migration, then you're going to start to see the value proposition and the business model become viable. Until then, it's an investment to allow for the technology to incubate and work out the bugs.
I mentioned earlier that we're seeing a lot of collaboration amongst the automakers, far more than we've seen in any other technology. I mentioned GM and Honda working together. I want to say Daimler, Nissan, mm-hmm. Ford are working together. We just saw Volkswagen buy a part of Ballard, the Canadian company that's been one of the leaders in this technology for an awful long time. Some people have told me this is going to come down to a patent war. Who owns what patents on it? How do you see that?
Definitely, we see the race for IP protection is significant. I would say historically, there'd been a perception that the auto industry had done that as a means to limit competition. Going back to Tesla, they've come out with the let's make it available to everybody. So there's also a philosophical approach in and around some of the incubation phase of technology. So technologies that need that catalyst, I think, are going to see more collaboration because the capital investment required to do the research and development is cost prohibitive for companies and their bottom line. So I think in these areas of new technology and growth, you're going to start to see more of this collaboration until it can become commodity. And then, it's more of a manufacturing and volume driven value equation.
Yep. Gil, we're getting down towards the end here, but is Hyundai going it alone? Do you have a partner? How do you see this whole patent war thing rolling out?
There's certainly some discussions going on, which I really can't talk about, but I think there's room for a lot of players in this area. And I think part of the reason why you're seeing the collaboration is because OEMs do believe in the technology and they do want to see it succeed. Later down the line, when we actually get into volumes and we start to see more of a traditional type of competitive landscape, I think that's where we're going to see some of this kumbaya kind of go away, if you will. But for now, I think there's vested interest in everyone to kind of hope and see this technology succeed.
Levi, we are getting down to the end here now. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts on that, this collaboration and maybe people staking out who owns what IP?
I'm from an academic institution. Collaboration is sort of in our blood, and it's part of the reason why we can make the great advances. You have someone that's knowledgeable about one thing, someone knowledgeable about another thing. You start bringing the pieces together, you can make more than just the sum of the parts. And I think that's exactly what they're trying to do. You know, I can't tell you exactly, but my thought is that if you could find ways to collaborate, you'll probably get there a lot faster, and I think the consumer would benefit from that.
And that's a great point to end up this discussion with. I want to thank all three of you for having come on today's show. Chris Hennessy, the Vice President of Engineering at IAV Automotive, Professor Levi Thompson at the College of Engineering with the University of Michigan, and Gil Castillo, the Senior Group Manager for Alternative Vehicle and Advanced Vehicle Strategy at Hyundai. Thank you all for coming on today.
Thank you.
And of course, I want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Underwriting for AutoLine this week has been provided by
Cars. They've always captured our imagination. What they look like, how they move, and the places they take us. And because you've always loved them, you deserve to love the experience of buying them.